Committee on Health Care. And let me open a public hearing on Senate Bill 153. Senator Montes Anderson shows up. We'll do a little switcheroony. He's sent for her. We'll see.
It's a technical term.
That's a term of art. Switcheroony.
Switcheroony.
Sandy, you want to tell us what 153 is about?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 153 requires employee benefit plans and health insurers to reimburse state Medicaid expenditures made for a benefit of an enrollee under specified circumstances. It requires the employee benefit plans and the health insurer to provide eligibility and claims data to a state Medicaid agency upon the request, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. In your packet, Mr. Chair, committee members, you do have a fiscal impact statement that was issued, and it is just that. It is a statement of explanation, not necessarily a fiscal dollar amount per se. And we also have the A2 amendments that were requested prior to our hearing. This left the Senate floor with 25 ayes, 2 noes, and 3 excused. And the 2 noes were Senator Beyer and Farioli.
Beyer's still ahead, right? Thanks. Can we have Tricia Baxter and Cindy Becker come and talk to us? Any order.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Tricia Baxter. I'm the administrator for the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery with the Department of Human Services. This bill was introduced at our request.
It's a big card, huh?
Yeah, it's a big card, Chair Greenlick. This bill, I'm here to speak to you in support of Senate Bill 153, and what the passage of this bill will do is to bring the state of Oregon into compliance with Section 6035 of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. The Deficit Reduction Act in that section does 2 things. It clarifies the specific entities that are liable for payment as third parties and health insurers, and it clarifies that they cannot discriminate against individuals on the basis of Medicaid eligibility. Second, and most important to the Department of Human Services, is that it requires states to pass laws that will require health insurers to share information with the Department of Human Services as the Medicaid agency regarding coverage of Medicaid clients for other third-party insurance. It also lays out some specific time frames for in which we can file claims, and those insurers then need to honor those claims. Again, the 2 things that this bill accomplishes for us bring us into compliance with the Deficit Reduction Act, but also will help the agency to ensure that Medicaid is always a payer of last resort in allowing us to obtain insurance information that sometimes is challenging to obtain at this time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Cindy, you want to add something to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Cindy Becker, Executive Director of COHO. Basically, my testimony is what she said. The managed care plans are responsible for the third-party reimbursement, and so the department let us add the prepaid health service organizations into the language so that the insurance companies also have to report the Medicaid eligibility to the plans. The department is responsible for that for the fee-for-service providers, and we're responsible for the managed care. And so all this does is for the COHO members, actually all for the managed care plans, is add us to that language. An amendment, the -2 amendment, was an oversight in a couple of clauses that didn't add the prepaid managed health services organization language.
Is that Cote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question for Ms. Baxter. On item number 1, the Deficit Reduction Act does, can you talk a little bit more about the not discriminating against individuals on the basis of Medicaid eligibility? I'm trying to get a sense of what was happening before and what's not going to happen now because of the DRA.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Kotek, actually, I'm not aware of any instances of that occurring within the state of Oregon. Evidently, it must have been an issue with other states, but all I know is that it's requiring us to say they can't discriminate against individuals based on their eligibility for Medicare. From that, I can assume certain things.
For Medicare?
Or excuse me, Medicaid. I can assume certain things that in some states maybe there were problems where health insurers were dropping Medicaid clients if they found they were eligible for Medicaid. But we have not experienced that, to my knowledge, within the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Just curious. Thank you.
Representative Cannon?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question that goes perhaps a little bit outside the purview of this bill, but it's on a related subject, so maybe you can enlighten me. I'm very curious. It sounds like Medicaid is the, you said it's the payer of last resort. My understanding is that Medicare is the payer of first resort. How do we get to that place? Am I right in that understanding?
Well, Medicare is not necessarily the payer of first resort. If you have employment-based health insurance while you're a Medicaid recipient, in fact, the employer-based health insurance is the payer of first resort, and Medicare second. And they do a survey every year as an old Medicare hand now. Find out whether you have private-based insurance. Well, the way they get away with it is they just write a federal statute that says that's the way it is.
Well, we can have further conversations about it. Kind of a federal issue, but...
It is a federal issue, yeah.
That shouldn't stop us.
We can talk about rural health. Even better. But the point here is that it is clear that Medicaid is not the payer of first resort if people have health insurance.
Correct.
And we do that with both state and federal statute, right?
That's correct, Chair Greenlich.
Okay. Any other questions? We have voting. We have the ability to vote. What about a motion on the desk, two amendments? Oh, we have Senator Bates with us. I'm sorry. Close the public hearing, open the work session, and Senate Bill 153.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -A2 amendments to Senate Bill 153.
Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Stand by just a moment.
Stand by.
I'm trying to find them.
Here they are.
There's
I have an extra. They're in the packet that she left here.
Housekeeping,
that's
right?
Well, I think I have an extra.
I definitely do.
Right here.
That's two.
There you go. They simply add a prepaid managed care services organization.
I see. Sounds fine to me.
Okay. #2s are part of Senate Bill 153. How about a motion on the bill itself?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 153A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion on that motion? Aaron, would you please call the roll? And everybody who's not here has been excused.
Representative
Bonanni, excused. Representative Flores, excused.
Representative Gelfler. Aye.
Representative
Maurer,
excused. Vice
Chair Wheaton.
Aye.
Aye. And Senate Bill 153.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 153A as amended to the consent calendar.
Excellent. Is there any objection to that? 153 goes to the consent calendar with a due pass recommendation. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 153. Who says we can't get things done?
Oh, we're cranking.
I don't know if I can find the schedule. Senator Bates, what are we here to talk about tonight? We'll open up. Is that 337? Let's open a work session. Senate Bill 337 carried over from yesterday. Can you explain this dumb bill to us?
I'm not sure I can anymore. For the record, I'm Al Bates, State Senator.
I take that down.
State Senator from District 3 down in Medford and Ashland. And I'd like to discuss just for a few months Senate Bill, a section of Senate Bill 337 with you just for a few moments. 337 is an attempt, and I think a very good attempt, of very difficult work groups to come together over a period of several months to to try to iron out some very difficult problems that have been occurring in the state for years. And this is the farthest we ever got with these issues. It's issues of peer review versus what the public has a right to know. It's an issue of identifying physicians who are having difficulty in restricting their licenses or taking their licenses. Obviously came to head over a case we all know about out of the Portland area where certain entities didn't report to the Board of Medical Examiners what's going on. The board has to have certain information to do its job. Yet we have to protect peer review, and we don't want to be in a situation where doctors who frankly basically have nothing more than their reputation this day and age to lean on get tarnished by frivolous lawsuits that are brought up and then dropped, of which 80% are. At the same time, public has a right to know. So almost every word in this was done very carefully. I will give you an understanding also that this is not constitutional. We got February, we got 2009, but we'd like to have this bill go through basically unchanged and give it a chance to work for a couple of years to see where we're really at, see if we're doing the job we need to do through the board, see if we're doing what we need to do as far as disclosure to the public. There is in this bill a Scribner's error, one we're trying to correct here with the -4 amendments. The agreement was very clear on this the time these work groups worked together, and this is concerning what the board puts on its website, what it reports publicly. And the idea at that point was that if there's not been a finding of negligence, if there's not been a monetary settlement, the board would not publish that. Individuals would call up and say, well, I want to know about Dr. So-and-so. Has he ever had anything brought against him? And they can say, well, he's had claims against him. There's never been negligence. There's never been any financial change going on. That was worked out as part of the consensus. The part of the bill we're concerned about, which is on page 3, starting at line 4, 5A, does not say that. And so the board is correct, as all the other parties agreeing that this is not the language needed, -4 amendments, correct that language to make it look like the consensus that we had. I understand that the people who feel that more should be put on those websites about doctors, whether the suit was brought against them that had negligence involved that was proven, or whether they had a financial settlement against the physician. Those people, many people feel that that doesn't matter. Everything should be up out there. As soon as a claim is filed, it should be on the website for the Board of Medical Examiners. It should be public knowledge. To a great degree, it is public knowledge when a suit is filed, obviously. Putting on the board's website is something we didn't really want to have happen at this juncture, at least. The consensus of those committee or that work group was that this is the way the bill should go out. There are a lot of things besides that.
Work group. Which parties?
The Board of Medical Examiners and their attorney, the OMA and their attorney, the Hospital Association and their attorney. I want to say it was very difficult at times. Okay? Extremely difficult at times.
Mm-hmm. A lot of attorneys.
Huh?
A lot of attorneys.
Medical. This is say, I'm going to tell you it's just difficult. I'll tell you how bad it was in private sometime, okay? Now we're sitting in the middle of it trying to make this thing go through and put it together, and we got this far, which is really a huge step forward in this particular thorny problem. So I would ask you to put the -4s in, and unless there's another error in this, Scribner's error of another type that we haven't seen, we move this bill forward. Now, I got to tell you, I'm a little concerned about a lot of the stuff coming out of LC, as a lot of other people are, too. We have new people down there. They're trying to learn their job. They're pushing things out fast. I've had two or three bills come through that we've had significant errors in that changed dramatically what the bill said that wasn't caught until later on. So I'm hoping the rest of this bill is clean. There's no more conflicts or no more difficulties.
You apparently do have a conflict piece in that.
Another one besides this? Is it in the bill or with another bill?
It's with another bill. But it's a term. It is clearly just a term. It is impaired licensee versus licensee with an impairment with Senate Bill 83. So it's there is a conflict
they
with
can
that.
Handle that.
And they can't. They just need to know
which bill needs to be corrected.
This one.
This one.
We will. This one is correct. That we will be deleting on line 4.
Okay.
14.
We have a -5.
The conflict amendments we just got.
Did you give Dr. Bates on this?
Page 4 of the A and Gross, line 14, where it says, and impaired, we will delete that and insert a licensee with an impairment.
This is page 4, line
14.
You've got a copy there now.
It carries over into line 15.
I got you
it says impaired licensee. to remove that conflict, we will change that to a licensee with an impairment. And that conflict is with an omnibus bill, apparently Senate Bill 83.
Respectful language bill.
Which was it?
That changes everything that's our...
Probably.
An individual...
Yeah, instead of a disabled person, it's a person with a...
An individual with a disability.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I would ask you, obviously, to accept the A4s and the A5s. Hopefully, that makes this clean.
Senator, let's rebid the hand if we can. The critical thing about this is making sure people are reporting these things to the board. Is that right? I mean, that's
the most important thing that we've, my opinion, there are other things involved here. There were certain, by a previous Oregon law before this changes, you could be a self-insured entity and have lawsuits that showed negligence and showed monetary rewards being made and not report to the Board of Medical Examiners. This piece of legislature closes that loophole. That is one of the most important pieces of this. We don't want to lose that. The board has a right and a need to know that. And some of these self-insured entities are very large with a lot of physicians in them.
Is Kaiser Permanente?
Kaiser would be one. Legacy would be one. Samaritan, I think, is always reported, but they could be. These are a lot of physicians in these groups. And we did not realize there was that loophole. And we found out the hard way. This bill closes that loophole. There are other things in here also. The other issue here is, just as the board has a right to know things, it has to know things to protect the public and do their job, we also have to have an ability to do peer review in this state. And peer review is really important, especially in hospital settings, where you can sit down with your peers, talk about specific cases that people have differences of opinion on, and have really open discussions. It gets quite heated sometimes. I've had people end friendships over these discussions, but they're good for patient safety, and they're good for patient treatment. We don't want that to be something that becomes what we call discoverable, so people will stop going to peer review, or they'll keep peer review going, but they'll just won't talk about certain things. We don't want that to happen. We want peer review to be continue to be protected and to be robust and to continue in our hospital settings so that cases that didn't go well or new procedures come in can really be discussed and argued over before we start doing them or we change our practices in the hospital. I've seen it happen.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, Senator Bates.
Representative Richardson, good to see you again.
Nice to see you. We have a couple of facets with the bill, and certainly the one that you're talking about there is vitally important. The one that I have concerns about is whether we are stepping back from the move toward greater transparency. And the concerns I have are on page 3 of the bill, because in 5A it says, which is what the dash 4 deals with, it says basically that this line that says that there shall be nothing provided would become may not publicly post. Okay, I understand that. But on lines 13 and 14 and 15, it says a board may not publicly disclose or publish any allegations or factual assertions included in the claim unless the complaint resulted in a judicial finding or an admission of liability. And my understanding is more than 90% of these cases either go away, and that's one thing, but or they get settled. And so this is saying that if there was a settlement, then there will be no information which led up to that settlement disclosed to the public. So regardless of how egregious the situation is or how frequently it may have occurred with the same physician, what I see is that if there's a settlement involved, there will be no disclosure because there cannot be any public disclosure or publishing of any allegations. And to me, that seems like that is a step back toward the old boy kind of appearance to the people, where the people can't find out if any physician they want to know about is having multiple claims or what are those kinds of things, so long as they were settled.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'll go back to two things in this. One is that this is a consensus piece. We start pulling pieces out now, and we may not get what we need as far as concurrence is concerned, and I don't want to lose this bill. It's too important, the other parts of it. I think we probably still would, but I'm concerned. All parties have agreed to this language. And if we need to go back and work this and work group again before the next session, I'll be glad to do it. To me, a judicial finding, and I am not a lawyer, and we should probably have others answer that question for you, a settlement to me is admittedly not in front of a judge, not in front of a jury, but it is a settlement in which a payment was made. My understanding would be, and I may be wrong, is that would be reportable in a public way. Anytime. That,
what about using the same language above the list in 6 and 7?
I don't want to start messing with this thing. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I understand what we need, the dash 4s, the dash 5s. This is a work group type of problem. I think that if you put 4s and 5s in here, you'll have a working agreement. We can look at it in a year and a half. See how it's functioning. If that that website goes blank all of a sudden, we know we haven't done the right thing. But if we are in a situation where everything's getting reported to the board, finally, and the board feels comfortable with the information they're getting, if we start getting complaints from the public, I think we can deal with it at that time. This has been incredibly difficult to work out. It's been laying there for years, and we're trying to bring it forward. And we might need a second bite at the apple later on, but I would implore you to try to just do a 4 and a 5, clean this bill up as far as Scribner's are concerned. Let's get this bill on through. And then if we find it's not functioning the way we want it to, let's sit down and work it through before the next session and fix it from that point. We'll have some experience with it. We have more people now knowledgeable of it. People from this committee can help us with it. This is not an exclusive work group. We're glad to bring everybody in, and we can change things. But I'm worried that here it is, almost the beginning of June. We got a couple weeks to go. Don't want to lose this bill.
Well, let's get the three parties up and ask them whether they would have a problem using the same language in line 13 that's used in line 6. And it seems to me that's not something that should be a problem.
We have the OMA, we have BME.
We have the OMA, we have BME, and we have...
Don't know if anybody from the
hospital.
We have,
hospital.
We have the gnome of Beaverton here.
Okay. Gnome from Beaverton. Who totally... Oh, here he comes. He heard you.
I agree with you, Dr. Bates. Senator Bates, we want to make sure we can move this because it does move it forward. But if we can make us feel more comfortable without making the parties feel less comfortable, I think that's something we'd be happy to do. You need a copy of the bill? What I'm looking at is we're on page 3. Representative Richardson's questioned the language on line 12 and 13. And the question is whether we could use the same language there that's used in line 6 and 7 as opposed to a judgment.
Judgment or judicial finding?
I mean a judicial finding or an admission of liability. Whether we could use the language that says a money judgment or award or a settlement that involves a payment to the claimant. We'd be glad to give you a chance to think it over, to have a conversation. Because I think our preference would be to do that. Is that...
Mr. Chair?
If that doesn't unravel the agreement.
Mr. Chair, I feel like I'm on a game show. The clock is ticking here.
Deal or no deal?
Phone call. And the problem is this. The way the work groups work, we go over language like this, and then all three parties go back and check with their boards, get buy-off or not get buy-off, come back in, argue it again, word for word, go back out, come back in, go back out, come back in. And that went on for several months. I think these people are being asked to make a decision on some language that they're going to say, I don't know what they're going to say, but they may say, you know, folks, I'm going to go back and check with my board. That'll take a week, week and a half. I mean, Mr. Bishop, I don't think has had a chance to be real familiar with this. Gwen is the attorney who worked the most.
Not here today? Okay.
So, I mean, we get into a quagmire. I don't want to be in a situation where this thing blows up later because people said, hey, we agreed to something. That was what was supposed to be in the bill. And now at the last minute in committee, it gets changed without a full discussion.
Well, that's why there are two houses in this building, because sometimes I've noticed my bills going over there don't always go zooming through. You may have noticed that. But
point taken, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I had a question. I was kind of pondering the issue of the timeline and the question that Representative Richardson had. When I had read it initially, I did read it in the way that Senator Bates described, that that would include a money judgment, because the judicial, I mean, someone's not just going to write a check on their own. It seems that there would be a judicial judgment that is involved in putting that together. So I guess one of the things that I'm wondering, being sensitive to the idea of many people coming together and individuals representing large groups, if there's a way that we could move this but put on a sideboard that we come back in the interim to look at if there's been an impact there, if we're ready to fix it?
If we're in the same kind of organization in the interim, we are definitely going to look at all the boards and their question of disclosure. I think that's an important issue to deal with in the interim. But I was just going to propose this. Let us get we will move the bill for you. Let's get an amendment that essentially uses the language in line 13 that's in line 6 and 7. And it'll take us certainly till next Tuesday to get that. And it'll give the parties a chance to see whether that drives them crazy or not, and we can talk about it at the...
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? I want to be perfectly clear what we're doing
here. What does the no mean?
Huh?
I'm getting vibes from behind.
Well, I can't see what's happening behind me.
It's probably a good thing.
Okay. What you're asking is that the language on line 13, which starts, a board may not publicly disclose or publish,
right,
be substituted into line 6?
No. Line 6, line 5 and 6 are the dash 4s. And they talk about...
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. And I'm sorry if I missed the beginning of this discussion. I had to be elsewhere for a few minutes. But can you please just reiterate the reason for this suggestion you're making? I just want to make sure I understand why.
To broaden because so many of the malpractice claims, this is what Representative Richardson,
right,
ends up without a judicial finding or admission. They end up with an out-of-court settlement that ends up with money, sometimes a lot of money.
Mr. Chair, may I make a comment without being too specific on the language itself?
You may.
I don't mean to be aggressive here, but...
I feel reassured about that.
Maybe I do mean to be aggressive, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sky Gallant. I'm the Associate Executive Director of the OMA. Physicians are required to notify and tell the BME when a claim is filed against them. Okay? So the BME is, in fact, made aware of that. What we've tried to do in this process is still inappropriately enable the board to try to track these things to see if there's some kind of pattern. What this section is saying is it really appropriate where you have 80% of cases, or you have a claim, 80% of them disappear. There's no investigation of the allegations. There's no conclusion to whether there was negligence or inappropriate activity, okay? So, but the board is aware of it. And what we're trying to say here is that really appropriate to put, you know, to have out there where you've not even had a basis or an evaluation through the judicial process?
Well,
just an allegation.
This isn't an allegation when you settle a court for, you settle a claim for $5 million out of court. That's not just an allegation. But what we're talking about, and actually we're not talking about only line 13, we're talking about 13 and 15, is up above you say, the board that receives a report of a claim under this section may not publicly post any information about that claim if the disposition claim does not result in a money judgment, an award, or a settlement that's based on a... that involves a payment to the claimant. and we're saying you agreed to that language. Now I'm saying let's just put that same language down in line 13 and line 15. That simply says the board may not disclose or publish any allegations or factual assertions, including the claim, unless the claim resulted, and now let's go to that same language, unless the claim resulted in a money judgment, an award, or a settlement that involves a payment to the claimant. It's just making it consistent with the section above. And, I mean, that's all I was suggesting. It doesn't seem particularly damaging. We heard a case of a woman who ended up losing the eyesight of an eye because she had surgery by a physician who at that time had several malpractice claims against him, all of which were settled out of court, including one she later had that was settled out of court. And when she called the board to find out information, the information she got caused her to believe, I'm not saying what the information was, but it caused her to believe that there were no problems with this physician. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there were problems with the physician, and the physician was later sanctioned rather seriously by the board. Now, if a physician has seven malpractice claims against him, all settled out of court for a lot of money, it seems to me that's information that a patient ought to be entitled to have. And that's all this suggestion here is doing at this point.
And in that instance, I happened to be at the hearing, Mr. Chairman. And there was, in fact, a settlement with a monetary payment. So under this bill, that would, in fact, be information.
Not in line 15, it wouldn't.
Look at line 16.
I mean, look at line 16, which defines it.
But doesn't Mr. Chair, doesn't 5A, paragraph 5A say that if there's a, with the dash fours, that if there's been a money judgment, it'll be posted.
It'll be posted, but there won't be any information about the allegations or the assertions. That's what this section's about.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would agree with you that it's very difficult to do rewrite bills in front of committees.
Well, then, I'm suggesting another alternative. Let me get an amendment and share it with the parties and see what it looks like to you. At that time, I'll give you a chance to think about it, including Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking about timelines and the difficulty of getting everybody together and getting something out that everyone might agree to. The way I originally read this from my memory was that if there was a financial claim against a physician, it would be posted. If there was negligence, there would be posted. If there was a judicial finding, it would be posted.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, and I still think, that 5A and 5B do that. I can see why there would be confusion in this looking at it. I believe that's what the board would be doing, and I would like to ask Mrs. Haley if she agrees with that or disagrees with that. Under those three conditions, either financial settlement, a judicial settlement, or an admission of liability, any one of those three should cause it to be posted. Am I incorrect in that?
Chair Greenlech, Senator Bates, I think you're correct. We would post the name of the physician and the facts as you stated them and the dollar amounts.
But not the factual assertions or the allegations.
Chair Greenlech, that's correct.
Mr. Chair,
would you please introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Kathleen Haley, Executive Director for the Board of Medical Examiners.
Yeah, this isn't about posting. 5A is about posting. This is about whether or not, what are the conditions under which you reveal the allegations or factual assertions.
Mr. Chair, and it's my understanding also that information would be easily available to anyone wanting that information by a simple phone call. I believe that's correct. Is that correct, Kathleen?
Chair Greenlech, Senator Bates, that information would be, I think if there was a dollar payment under existing language of B, the board staff would not be able to talk about the allegations.
Not be able to.
Correct.
Under B.
As it is currently.
Yeah, that's the problem we're having with it. John Bonamici?
I think my question's been answered. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, let me just make sure I understand this, because I'm reading this now for the fourth time, and every time it looks a little different to me. But 5A says that if there's a claim that has resulted in a money judgment, an award, or a settlement, then that must be posted. 5B goes a little further and says if that was claim, if the board has disclosed information about a claim, presumably because it was triggered in 5A, and there's a further finding of fault, not just a settlement, not just a money judgment, but a finding of actual negligence by a judicial authority, then we're going to give you more, even more information.
Right.
So it's sort of a tiered, as I read it, there's a triggering event for 5A, which is a pretty broad one, a out-of-court settlement, for instance. And the a sort of steeper, a higher hurdle to cross for 5B, which is a finding of fault in order to disclose more information.
That's
right. Okay.
And now
And the other side of that is they can't disclose any other information
unless,
except under these circumstances.
However, it is the case that if there was an out-of-court settlement, the person who calls up or goes online will see that information online. They'll see the settlement. They won't get information about the further information that's under 5B.
About the assertions.
Okay.
Or allegations. Right.
I'm clear on it now.
They will only get it online or on the phone if there is the higher level.
Right.
And we're suggesting the same level.
This only deals with cases that are actually filed, and so if the person who wanted to know it wanted to go to the extra effort, they could contact the court and get a copy of the complaint, because those allegations would be included in a complaint that was filed somewhere. But the real question is that what they need to do, or should that be disclosed if there is a settlement by BME?
Mr. Chair, now I do have a question. Thank you. In line 11, where we're talking about disclosing information, I remember yesterday we were talking about the two different disclosures. There's the posting and then there's the phone calling. So is line 11 referring to the disclosure of information that's posted, in which case it should be consistent with the language in 5A? If it's the phone call, then that's a different situation. So
he's reported that they won't be able to give it even under a phone call under 5B. That's what Ms. Haley said. It would be posted as a case, and they call him and say, what the hell was this case about? And the answer is, we can't tell you.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Scott Gallant.
For the record, Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association.
The further distinction is that you don't have example of a complaint, there isn't a judicial finding. In other words, someone filed a claim, right? And there was no finding, period. No judicial finding.
That's right. I need to give you $3 million if you agree not to talk about the case.
Using an extreme example, I file a claim against Dr. Cannon, making allegations. Right,
mm-hmm.
And say my prayer is $4 million, and I am suggesting that he ripped off my left arm and my middle toe on my right foot.
Right.
Okay. The claim, the allegation, and of that, and the claim is dropped. There's no judicial finding that, in fact,
dropped is a. I mean, let's be sure. Three things can happen to your claim against him, right? Thing is, he can say there's no basis and screw you and we'll take it to court. Or he could say, his insurance company could say, well, I'm not going to admit to anything, but I'll give you your $4 million. And that's the case we're talking about.
The case where...
where his insurance company says, we're not going to admit to anything, but we'll give you the $4 million just as long as you agree not to talk about it. That won't be covered in 5B. That's the case that's got us nervous.
I'm not sure that is the case, Mr.
Well, Ms. Haley said it was the case. So that's the only testimony we have.
Mr. Chair, if what they will know is that it was a settlement.
And there was a case.
There was a case. And will they know how much the settlement was?
No.
They'll know there's a settlement in the case.
Will they know how much the settlement was?
Yes.
They'll know how much
my understanding was they know how much the settlement was.
Right.
And they can get that information. And any more information that they want, they can get from the court.
Is that true? I mean, I don't know.
I assume it is.
Mr. Chair, sometimes settlements are confidential.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I would offer if an agreement between two parties is confidential, why would the Board of Medical step in and make it non-confidential? You know, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but that doesn't seem appropriate.
Well, they're going to post it. There's a money settlement under 5A.
I would expect that most of these kind of settlements you're talking about are probably there's an agreement they're going to be confidential. And does the board then, I'm going to give the board the power to go into a case that's been settled as confidential and money settlement's been made, no negligence found, but now the board's going to open that case up, even though the court has sealed it, and make it available publicly?
Mr. Gelser and then Mr. Maurer.
Thanks. I had two questions that were just kind of devil's advocate in this conversation here. The first, am I understanding correctly that if there's not, so if it's a situation where there's been a settlement but not a judicial finding, the fact that there is a settlement and the amount of money will be reported. So if I am going to choose an obstetrician and I go to see what's posted and I see that there are a $2 million settlement, a $5 million settlement, a $1 million settlement against this obstetrician, I might not know what the facts of the case are, but the fact that there are multiple settlements against that person in large amounts of money might give me pause.
That'll be on the website, under 5A, right?
Chair Greenlick, that will be available but not published on the website under the -4s.
Well, you may not post it.
Well, it says if it does not result in...
Yeah, no, that's right. It says you can post it unless it results in a money judgment.
Right.
And you can.
Which means you can post it.
You can post it.
Is there an earlier section unless that says you can't?
Unless it's more than 4 years ago, in which case you can't.
Mm-hmm. That means you can. It's a negative there.
5A says that it says that if it's a money judgment, but it's a negative. It says you can't post it unless there's a money judgment.
Okay.
Is what 5A says.
Yeah.
So if there's a money judgment, then I would be able to look at a given doctor and note that there are multiple large judgments against that person. And then my second question, I'm kind of reflecting back on the discussion.
Lori?
That we had the other week when we were talking about the power to order the evaluations by the review boards, and we wanted to provide due process to the physicians or the professionals who were considered to be impaired. And I'm wondering if that same corollary might not be true here, that if there's an allegation against a physician that is dismissed, wouldn't we want to have this kind of sideboard here so that we weren't exposing a doctor who maybe had a claim against him from having all of those published to everyone when there had never been a finding of liability. And I wonder if that might be the intention of this, is to kind of find that balance between making sure that people know when there are large money settlements against physicians, but also enticing them to participate by knowing that any allegation that's thrown out isn't going to be tossed up on a website that, as we discussed on that other issue, might undermine their professional credibility and their livelihood.
Let me, I do want to end this, and I do want to assure Senator Bates that we're going to pass this. So let me get a draft amendment together. Let's put it on the agenda for Tuesday of next week. I mean, let me get a draft amendment and give you all a chance to look at it and see whether it sets your hair on fire. Not you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. I would ask also that...
Not Mr. Bishop and not me, but other than that, if it sets anybody's hair on fire.
I think the other issue here, and this is, there's been a couple of months that this work group has met, the other issue coming back to me, and I think this is correct, is that in most cases where there's been a settlement and a money amount, there almost invariably is an agreement between the two parties that there's been no negligence, and no liability from that point of view, and it's a sealed agreement.
Actually, I don't think that's the agreement. The agreement is there's no admission of negligence.
No admission, okay. There's no admission of any negligence, and that it is sealed. And that without that sealing, there's probably not going to be a settlement. And so that's going to open this thing up to potentially either the board has power to break into a settlement that's been sealed from a court point of view, and there may be some legal things there that says you can't do that, or maybe the board can do it, depending on how we write this bill. That's an issue that needs to be looked at. And it's one I think we discussed in this, and that's why that work group worked so long and so hard. So we're opening up a can of worms I'm concerned about here from that point of view. The other issue there also is whether or not we want to start breaking this consensus down. And I'm going back to that again because this was really hard to get to this point. Please be careful.
Okay. Representative Maurer, did you want
to... One last point, and Senator Bates, I think, hit the nail on the head, is that if you have a settlement, most likely the settlement is confidential. But now we're saying, well, regardless of that, we are going to disclose the amount. And I won't say from my experience, because I have none, but from my understanding is that even those amounts are confidential. They have been, not in Oregon, I'm saying outside of Oregon, in the United States. A lot of cases are settled and the amounts are never disclosed. But now we are disclosing amounts. And those are going to be available to the public. And so I'm getting back to Dr. Bates's point that I think that messing with this, I think, may be an issue.
Yeah. Well, let's see if we can improve it without unraveling it.
Thank you.
If we can't, then we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad I still have my hearing.
Well, I hope we'll stop it from burning over the next...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates, thank you for the hard work on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. And I hope when we meet again in a few days, I can remember what I said and did here today. Thank you.
I'm going to send you a recording.
Okay. Probably have to. Thank you.
I close the public hearing on, the work session on Senate Bill 337A. And we'll open up the first public hearing on... Which one? On Senate Bill 717, we'll ask Senator Anderson, Thomas Anderson, to join us. I won't say the same thing I said to Senator Bates. Explain this dumb bill.
No, this is not a dumb bill. Good afternoon.
His wasn't either. That was an inappropriate statement.
Thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson from the Gresham area. That includes Wood Village, Troutdale, and Fairview. This is a simple bill, really, and I think every legislator would love it. It's three words, scope of practice, and I think you've had many scope of practices in front of your committee already. And it is an extremely serious subject, but we are... The medical field is getting more and more complicated. We're having chiropractors versus physicians, physical therapists versus occupational therapists, psychologists versus psychiatrists, ophthalmologists versus optometrists, and this battle goes...
Reflexologists versus...
Oh, golly, let's not forget them. This list goes on and on, and the battles, I think, are getting bloodier and bloodier as every session goes on and on. And so I was talking with the President of the Senate at the beginning of the session when I saw how many scope of practice bills there were in front of us, and I said, golly, I wish we could do something about it. And then we said, well, why don't we do something about it? And so that's how this bill evolved. It's truly it comes from the heart of the Senate President and from me that we truly need to have a better way of dealing with the scope of practice issues. And we truly wanted to look at
we don't really have time to look at what potential barriers to access if this change in scope is made, what new barriers or risks if we make this change, what are the health benefits to the public if we make this change, what is the cost effectiveness if we have a scope of practice change, what is the evidence-based information. And so in this bill, we took these specific areas, and then we had to find a convener, and we chose the Board of Medical Examiners as the convener simply because it is their responsibility to enforce the Medical Practice Act. So it just seemed appropriate that they would be the convener. But it just sets up a simple process, and what anyone who wants to have a scope of practice change would submit an application within 30 days. A subcommittee of the proponents and opponents would meet, and within 90 days they would need to come up with a decision taking into account all of the factors that I had listed and that are listed in the bill. So I would hope that this is not mandatory, but we put a sunset on it in 2012 because we wanted to see if the process does work. But I know it would make our lives simpler if we truly knew what a scope of practice could mean, because we need to be making good policy, and we, at many times, I'm not sure if it's good policy or not when we change scope of practice. So that concludes my testimony. I'm certainly open to any questions.
Representative Mullen? Representative Yoder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quickly, first off, I kind of wish we had names on this instead of out of a committee.
I know. I should have put my name on it but I was saying, golly, everyone's going to fight this. I thought, let's make it neutral so that no one would get blamed for this. But actually, everyone seems so positive about it. I wish we could have all put our names on it.
The amendments I really appreciate because I think it makes it more as much or as neutral as you can do in this whole process. And I appreciate the BME for stepping forward because I understand there were issues about other people that didn't want to touch it. But the one question I do have is you talked about cost effectiveness. And on page 2, it's this line 4 and 5 says the most cost effective means for accomplishing the proposed changes. Was there any discussion about a cost-benefit analysis of the change itself, determining whether an example from the past would be, is it better to the system that nurse practitioners are primary care providers versus not? I mean, in a lot of these cases, I think a lot of people ask the question, well, is not just quality, but how is this going to impact the system, as it were?
That's why we put in the bill, and I know that the original bill is in here somewhere, but I don't have the A engrossed in front of me, so I'm very sorry. But
yeah, both of them, would you like them?
Yes, just give me the A engrossed, and I'll point out to...
Here it comes.
Thank you. If you look at... the scope of the review committee, and it is the on page 2, line 4, the most cost-effective means. Hopefully, in that, when the committee's meeting, that they will address the cost of effectiveness. And I know it's not clarified as to the point that you're making, but that, to me, should be a part of when they're doing a cost-effectiveness analysis.
Okay.
It
does. I just was wondering if, because that's not how I read that. I read it as this is saying the actual implementation of this scope of practice change, is it cost effective? But is it a cost benefit analysis
to the health system?
To the health system in a larger sense.
Yes.
Because there may be pluses and minuses. The insurance companies may not appreciate it. The certain providers may appreciate it. The patients may appreciate it. And it's not appreciation day. But
and I think this, since it will be a trial 4 years, 5 years, mm-hmm. that these types of issues will probably come to light, I would hope. Because I truly feel we need to look at the cost-benefit and the cost-effectiveness and the cost-benefit. And probably that's what I meant. It's cost-effectiveness and cost-benefit. Okay. But hopefully that's implied in that subsection D.
Two quick points, if I may.
You absolutely may.
One point.
Giving up an exciting afternoon in the Agriculture Committee to be here.
I will have to jump back over there. We have an exciting bill to hear. Is substitute scope of practice and insert mandate?
We could. I mean, I had
hoped.
That's a good one. And the other.
That can be your take home bill in the next session.
The other. Issue.
You know, this isn't a mandate.
This isn't. No.
I'm talking about insurance mandate.
Oh, this insurance mandate.
I love this bill, but we could have another one that has the same process for insurance mandate.
No, that's a very good idea.
Okay. But my other comment is that this is only as valuable as the chairs of the health committees on both sides and the governor and the leadership in both chambers, how they value this, because they can bypass this process.
Exactly. And I feel that if there are bills coming before me as chair, and I'm putting this on the record, that if it is complicated and truly we do not know if good policy can be made from that scope of practice, I'm referring them to this committee, this process. There's no way I want to deal with scope of practice anymore unless it goes through this process.
Representative Cote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to see you, Senator. I love this bill. I guess, and I'm sorry I had to step out. Do we have anything like that, like this in other states?
No.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
Could we...
Not like this. No, there are other processes in other states, but nothing like this.
I think Iowa or Ohio has something.
Iowa or Ohio?
Yeah.
Well, I guess my follow-up would be...
I do have a number of... believe it or not, in 1997, we tried to do something like this. But I'm afraid that people who were here in 1997 would have to address that, but it never got anywhere. And there are other states that have other kinds of processes for scopes of practice, and the legislature doesn't deal with them.
Thank you. Well, I guess, and this might complicate things, but I would hate to see an end run around something like this, so what if we put language in here that said, you have to go here first, and then if you're not happy mm-hmm. with the process, then you can come to the legislature. I'm mm-hmm. guessing that people think they have a better shot at trying to convince a bunch of us what they want to do instead of going to a process like this.
The reason I like it this way, I want to start it out and work out the problems through the try the process first, get it going. We have no idea if there's going to be a fiscal. If we start mandating something, it could maybe have to be shifted down to ways and means, because if we mandate every scope of practice, we definitely need to have staff. So personally, I would rather set up the structure now and start working on it and then look to see how effective it is, and then we can look at maybe mandating it.
I don't think we can stop a legislator from introducing any bill the legislature wants to introduce.
True. Well, one thing is we could charge them a fee to do this, pay for it.
This is our time.
I'm opposed to increasing fees.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm so, having sat on this committee since January, I'm so grateful for this bill. I mean, really. And it's one of the few bills that we've seen this session, either in this committee or on the floor, that really gets to improving the kind of the process here and the decisions that we make. And so I think it's incredibly important. It's a fundamental piece of legislation. I'm so grateful for it. My question has to do, was there any concern about creating a sort of hierarchy of boards where you have the Board of Medical Examiners that's mm-hmm. helping to mediate, you know?
I hear a bunch of testimony.
Okay, we're going to get that. All right.
Yeah,
a lot of testimony, I think.
We tried to, we thought that we could have the... a number of different agencies, three different agencies that we approached to do this. Actually, we considered four, and then the Office of Health Partnership Research and Health Policy. They were neutral. We thought we would try them. No, it really wasn't in their purview. The group up at OHSU that works on evidence-based
practice center.
Yeah, and they said no. They really didn't want to do that. And so, and we wanted to make sure that the Board of Medical Examiners would not have. That they couldn't weigh in on the decision of the what came out of that committee. And so if you'll notice in the language, they are just the convener. They are not, they will not be weighing in on the decision that the committee comes forth with. And so we feel that this is a good place since they deal with scopes anyway, but they're not going to be weighing in because we did have that concern, and we feel that the way it's written, it will work out fine.
Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Senator. I agree with Representative Cannon that after all the issues that have come up on this committee, this is refreshing to see something that will help with that process. The question I have is there seems to not be clarity on what exactly is the scope of practice issue, because it seems like somebody will say it's a scope of practice issue and somebody else will say, no, it's not, it's a public safety issue. And so I'd want to see some kind of I guess, guidelines on how people get into this process. And also, I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about why the review committee would be composed of people who have, you know, proponents and opponents. It seems like the proponents and the opponents are the people who should be going to the committee rather than having them be the committee.
Within the committee, and we have two opponents and two proponents because they have their good reasons why this should or should not happen. And we feel that they can bring their information to the table. And then we have two neutral parties, one chosen by the proponents and one chosen by the proponents. And therefore, that committee... The way we have it now, when we set up task force, please go out in the hall and figure out what you can do to make this a better bill. This is what is actually supposed to happen within this committee, and it just makes sense. Rather than having this other committee, we don't think it would be that successful because the opponents or proponents will then come right back to us and say it didn't work here with those people, so we want it to work here. We just feel, let's start it this way. We'll see. We don't know. This is an experiment. But I feel it'll be far more productive to get the actual people at the same table working together, even though we haven't been able to do that with them.
I hope so, Senator, and yeah. I think you're probably better off with this than with the citizen legislature, but we'll see.
We'll see.
Representative Richardson?
Senator, something you just said was kind of contrary to what I read in the bill. I want to make sure that what you understand is what's here. And that's under Section 1C, where you've got two proponents and two opponents, and then there's going to be two others that are selected.
Yes.
It says two neutral members appointed by the proponents of the change who are appointed and the opponents of the change who are appointed. It doesn't
yes.
say that they would each
yes.
choose one. It says there will be two that are chosen by both of them.
Two neutral members appointed by the proponents who are appointed and the opponents who are appointed. So the way we had submitted it to LC was the opponents would probably end up choosing one and the proponents.
Okay, so I'm just saying it's not what it says.
Yeah, and I'm fine with it the way it is. If they can agree,
have to agree and
they would have to agree.
And
to
that's actually a good way that arbitrations
take place. It is. Thank you.
Senator, let me ask you one more question, then we'll let Senator Walker join us for another hearing. Probably the toughest... the most intransigent group we had in this session was a psychologist versus a psychiatrist on the psychologist.
And wasn't the ophthalmologist and the optometrist?
Oh, that one.
That was the second most intransigent group.
Well, let's not forget the PGs and the chiropractors.
But do you think that they could have worked out an agreement on whether psychologists should prescribe or not with this process?
If they need to address what we have put in the bill, barriers to access, new barriers, evidence-based practices, they need to come up with that information, use that information. The committee. And at this point in time, they don't take the time to even look at those things. They try to convince us from their point of view.
Yeah, but do you think that they would have actually, even in this process, been able to step back and come to an agreement? Something that would have satisfied both sides?
This is why we have a sunset on this bill, but I am hoping that they are adult enough and mature enough that they are going to look at these issues.
There's no evidence to that.
And if they come before us, we maintain the status quo. Truly, we need to have good health policy. And if we are going to make good health policy, we need to be addressing how it truly impacts the consumer, not the professions.
So in this case, if the psychologist could not have convinced the psychiatrist, then we would maintain the status quo?
It depends on the chair. Again, it needs enough flexibility that we as chairs of committees can determine whether we need to go forth or not. But we truly need this information, and I feel that if the proponents and opponents cannot come to us with the criteria that is set up in this bill, they need to go back and do their homework again.
So the purpose of the BME here then is for provide adult supervision. Okay. Senator Montesano, thank you very much. We have.
I would say that I think we might not have reached an agreement on the prescribing issue for psychologists, but I think we would have gotten a lot further. So when we came in, we would have been at a different starting point earlier. Yeah. I think
maybe, but some things seems to me aren't fact related; they're ideology related. And I mean, I think the psychiatrist absolutely didn't think there was any way to make any sense. I think the same thing may be true of the ophthalmologist and the optometrist, but the psychiatrist and the psychologist, somewhere along the line, you're going to have to take a side, I think. Anyway, Senator, thank you very much for coming. We'll have some testimony in a minute. I'll leave this hearing open and open a hearing on Senate Bill 378, and ask Senator Walker to come and talk to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill file's not this big. I just came from another committee. Don't get nervous.
Would you like one?
No, I have it. My staff read it for me. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Senate Bill 378 is actually a pretty simple little bill, but my colleagues in the Senate sort of got freaked out about it. You'll see some really interesting activity with it. There's a number of people in this building who support OHSU and all the good work it does. It does have its faults with regard to the Tort Claim Act, but we won't go there. So my colleagues were concerned that this bill impacted OHSU's funding in some way. So then when my colleagues on the other side of the aisle saw the bill was in trouble, they had fun with me. So anyway, the bill came back and we passed it, and those, such as the shenanigans that go on in the Senate from time to time. What this bill does, let me state that in 1995, the Legislative Assembly, and I don't think any of you were here in 95, the Legislative Assembly...
Sandy
was.
97. Oh, all right.
Okay, there you go. So this is all brand new. If you didn't know it, you will now. In 95, the Legislative Assembly passed a law saying that OHSU was a public corporation. Part of that law indicated that OHSU was not subject to any other law that applied generally to public bodies. that was enacted after January 1, 1995, unless the law specifically mentioned OHSU. So consequently, any law that passed since January 1, 1995 that imposed duties on public bodies and didn't specifically mention OHSU does not apply to OHSU. So what that means is legislative council has to look at every single bill related to public bodies to make sure it doesn't affect OHSU.
Or it does.
Or that it does. It's now, the onus is on legislative council to do this work, and you can imagine how many bills are related to public bodies. So I was having this conversation with legislative council in the interim when I was drafting many of my OHSU bills, and so we were discussing public bodies in this issue, and I said that's not the job for legislative council, it's the job for OHSU. They have hired lobbyists who do these sorts of things. So Senate Bill 378 simply reverses this rule that for all laws enacted after January 1, 2008, any law enacted in the February 08 session or any subsequent session will apply to public bodies generally, will apply to OHSU unless there is a specific exemption in the law for them. And that puts the onus on the university to ask to be exempted. It simply makes them do the work that they already do anyway and lessens the load for our legislative council. You will hear from OHSU that they are neutral on the bill. They'll tell you they do it anyway. So it's just a little cleanup bill, and I discovered that there's another agency that we do this with, and it's the Oregon State Bar. So I'll be coming back next session with a bill on the Oregon State Bar.
Is it true also in the Port of Portland? Is it similar standing?
They're not. I don't think so. I may be wrong, Mr. Chair, but if they are, I'll capture them next session.
I thought their standing was very similar to that.
Yeah, it's just silly. You know how hard our legislative council has to work just to keep up with us. And so I just figure OHSU can do their own work. And they do it anyway. They look at all the bills because they have to make sure there's nothing hidden in there, especially if I'm involved. They're always looking to see what I'm up to. I'm always trying to do something. And I held this bill for a really long time, Mr. Chair, because I was using it to make OHSU stay at the table and have a conversation about lifting that Tort Claims Act liability limit. And at some point, those negotiations broke down, so I moved the bill. It had a nice relating clause.
Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm back at the very beginning where we're trying to help LC, because the language we're taking out on page 1, lines 20 and 21, say that it doesn't apply to them unless the provision specifically provides that it applies to the university. And so I can't see how LC would be looking at all the laws, because if it doesn't specifically say it applies to the university, it wouldn't apply to them. And so they would only be concerned about where we spelled out the university. So I'm just trying to understand what it is we're really trying to fix, and is there possibly unintended consequences from saying that the university will now be subject to all the laws unless they opt out? Because that seems like it might actually be more burdensome than only being subject to the ones that specifically relate to the university, which is what we have right now. So I'm just trying to understand.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson. This bill only impacts OHSU. They must be exempt from general laws. It's a very complicated but very simple little bill that was hard to get our head around as well in my committee. But it just simply says that unless they're mentioned in the law, then it applies to them.
That's my point. See, right now, it doesn't apply to them unless they're mentioned in the law. And we're about to change that and say that all future statutes that apply to government entities will apply to them unless they opt out. And I just would see to me that might create unintended consequences greater than what you have right now, where it says that it only applies to them if they're specifically mentioned. So I'm just trying to see if it's doing what you really would like to have it do.
Well, Dave Hendricks was my drafter on this bill, and
Well, it sounds specifically like that's the intention.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
When they formed the bill, as I remember it, at that time I was the department chair at OHSU, so I was following it from that perspective. They picked out a set of statutes and included them in the OHSU Emancipation Bill, whatever it was called, and said all of these sections of the law apply to OHSU. And anything else that wasn't included in that original bill didn't apply. That's the sort of notion of a semi-public body, whatever it is. And since then, that's what's happened, right? If a bill is passed, they're only applied to OHSU if OHSU was mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And this would now say any bill relating to public bodies would relate to OHSU unless they were exempted from the bill.
Correct.
So includes PERS?
Mm-hmm. Well, they are including PERS.
Well, actually, they have...
They have some alternatives.
They have some alternatives. So I'm just saying that it seems to me like they're going to be busier than they are right now because they'll be having to weigh whether or not they are or shouldn't be.
Well, we're going to hear from them.
Yeah.
Senator Walker, thank you very much for reading this bill. I understand you need to be back on the floor in six minutes.
I do, and we have some very contentious bills. We didn't get many done this morning.
You're going to do some work this afternoon.
Yes, we are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Fortunately, they let our committees meet, which is very good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Barringer, you want to talk to us about this while we're open on this one?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
So, am I missing something here on the first page of this bill? The starting on line 18, subsection 3 that's removed, is identical to the subsection 3 put in except for the date? Or am I missing something?
Well, I'll ask Mr. Barringer to tell us about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Barringer. I'm with OHSU. If you could ask your question again, I was walking up and not...
Oh, it's quite right. The subsection 3 on page 1 that's being deleted is being replaced by subsection 3 that's in there in bold. And the only thing I can see that's different is the addition of end before January 1, 2008.
Yeah, I believe, and actually the minister may be able to help, or alleged counsel, but what they're doing there is, Chair Greenlake, Representative Kotek, is there the window for laws applying was originally before our public corporation enacted, and so they're now just creating a window around that section of time that Senator Walker mentioned is that we weren't captured by this new provision, so it would be prior to the date of the public corporation, and then 08 moving forward. But the language is very similar with just the change in the date, so I think that's correct.
It wasn't trying to go back and capture everything that's happened between 95 and 2008.
Correct.
Right. Thank you.
And that was discussed in the Senate. Thank you. I'm here to just provide a few comments on Senate Bill 78. Like Senator Walker mentioned, we are neutral on the bill. And we certainly do appreciate Senator Walker's willingness to add the amendment on the Senate side that creates this or makes this prospective. And that allows OHSU to proactively plan for this moving ahead rather than to try to determine over the last 12 years of legislative history what may or may not have impacted us while we were after the incorporation in 1995. A little additional background to what Senator Walker mentioned. In 1995, the legislature recognized that the OHSU structure had to change in order to fit in the increasingly competitive fields of healthcare and medical research. While change was needed, all involved wanted to retain OHSU's character and service as a public institution. The result was 353, which recreated OHSU as an independent public corporation. Under the Public Corporation Statute, OHSU is still subject to laws that apply to all public bodies and that relate to public accountability and transparency, including statutes like the Public Records Act, Open Meetings Law, and the Ethics in Government Statute. But in recognition of its unique place in a competitive business industry and its status as a public corporation, the legislative policy also provided that OHSU would not be swept into future broad-based legislation that would apply to public bodies in blanket fashion. Legislators that were working on the new OHSU statute were uneasy that public corporation advantages might be inadvertently be undone through the application of laws that might make sense to traditional public bodies but could be harmful to OHSU, much like I think Representative Richardson was pointing out. 353-103 imposed a disciplined approach to legislative drafting and decision-making, requiring drafters to assess whether new legislation should properly capture OHSU missions and operations. If they wanted to pull in OHSU, they would mention OHSU by name. It creates sort of an opt-in situation for bills that have general application to public bodies. Example that came up this session, Senate Bill 10, the ethics bill, was drafted and did not include OHSU. And so that was something that we caught in our tracking and something that we went and proactively asked to be added into at fiscal impact to OHSU, but it was the right thing to do. So that's kind of how the system works currently.
You get 174.
Under Senate Bill 378, all general legislation that applies to public bodies will now include OHSU's public corporation, and we will need to amend ourselves out of bills that don't apply. So there's some additional work there, you know, that's, I think, the standard. However, we believe this is the policy question for the legislature, whether by default the public corporation should be captured by bills mentioning public bodies, or we should continue to capture OHSU public corporation by specifically naming them. So thus our neutral position. Thanks, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, you can help me by talking to me about Section A and B under, I'm sorry, item subsection 1 and 2 under Section 5. It has ORS 174108 and 174109, which I have in front of me now, but I haven't had a chance to look at. It says, subject to ORS 108, is used in the statutes of the state. Public body means state government bodies, local government bodies, and special government bodies. Is OHSU one of those?
We previously were not, but I believe from legislative council testimony on the Senate side that their intent with this language was to add us into the last one, public bodies. Is that you said, special public bodies?
Doesn't add you in. It simply says anything that references that includes you. It doesn't define you any differently.
Okay. I can't answer that. Sorry. My understanding from the testimony on the other side was that was what Legislative Council was trying to do, was add us into that definition. Mm-hmm. But I, as not the drafter of the bill, I can't tell you.
And, Mr. Chair, also as not an LC drafter, Section 3... it amends 174.117, but their subsection 1 also says subject to 174.108, and it lists at that juncture, that's on page 2 of the bill, sir, it adds Oregon Health and Science University, so I'm wondering if adding them to that list then references it back into 174.108 rather than the 109.
Mr. Chair, committee staff, I think that
this defines special government body.
Yeah. That was my understanding from the Senate side.
That's right. That's what it is. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 378 and open back. What do we have? We still have 717 open. We have four representatives. Let's start with a panel opposed. Martin Taylor, Wayne Schumacher, and Phil Donovan. And following that, we'll have a panel of one supporting the bill, and that's John McCullough. I think by the 31st of May, we'll have seen all of you guys we want to see. Go ahead and some order, please. Kathleen, do you want to comment on this as well?
All right, I guess I'll start. I'll be the most long-winded of us, though, so I was going to make sure people go. But so this is really fun. You know, so far I've heard, I love this bill. I am so grateful for it. Not only to add to the awkwardness of a committee that's already clearly has some enthusiasm, I have tried as a principal to not cross either the Senate president or an only member in the legislature and Senator Miles Anderson. I'm afraid I may be doing both, but I will start with a little history. When we originally opposed this bill on the Senate side, we believed...
You want to pick on Senator Walker while you're at it, too?
No, on Senator Walker.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about people not to cross. The opposition that we originally expressed was to a bill that we didn't... Oh, sorry. For the record, Martin Taylor, Oregon Nurses Association. We thought we were opposing a bill that was a fall off of a national effort by the American Medical Association to review all the scopes of practices in the country, and it is a feeling that nurses have nationally that that is an effort that's really about trying to assert the influence of physicians over the definition of everybody's scope, including nurse practitioners and nurses. I think at a national level, it's probably a pretty safe claim. That is not the genesis of this bill. We did not realize that the proponents of the bill were going to be Senators Mona Sanderson and Senate President Courtney, and that this bill was really around trying to do an internal evaluation of how you make scope of practice decisions. So certainly in that spirit, when the work group was formed, we joined it. We came to some conclusions as a work group about a way of making this bill something that people could be comfortable with. And it started by housing the bill in a neutral body. We recommended the Office of Health Policy and Research, which seemed like a pretty good conclusion until the Office of Health Policy and Research decided they didn't want it. And that made it a significantly less good solution. The amendments that were adopted in the bill were not part of the work group and were not amendments that ONA either signed off on or agreed to be neutral on. I did agree to go back to our folks and say, in the amended form with a sunset, without any obligation to go through the legislature, and the way it's designed, how do you feel? To be honest, as a lobbyist, this is not my favorite bill to lobby against. I was okay with our folks feeling neutral, but they don't feel neutral. They met Saturday, and I would say that they feel strongly opposed to this bill. And so it's my job now to explain that, and I'm going to do my very best job trying to give you those facts. The first is that this bill does reinforce in the world of scope the idea that on top of medicine, that there is a hierarchy, and it is a hierarchy that falls under the Board of Medical Examiners and Physicians. What that represents to all folks who are not licensed on the Board of Medical Examiners is a very uncomfortable reinforcement of a status quo that we're trying to change. We believe that healthcare is a team approach, that in the healthcare facilities we work as teams, and that you ought to have a approach to how you do scopes that is not reinforcing that hierarchy. As a practical matter, this bill does not create the neutral environment that it purports to create. The convener of the process is the Board of Medical Examiners. They select all of the representatives, both the proponents and opponents, until those folks convene and then select the last two as a neutral group. So in a case where you have opponents that may come from a number of different scopes, from a number of different organizations, they get to select which opponents they want to put in this process and which proponents they want to put in this process. And it's staffed by the staff of the Board of Medical Examiners. Now, I'm not coming here to give you any objections to the work of the Board of Medical Examiners, but when we asked in our work group the very question, well, how would you feel if this was under the Board of Nursing? Would that be okay? The answer was no, it's not okay, it's under the Board of Nursing, for this very reason. Everybody has staff that are most accountable to their board members, and everybody has the same reaction. You could set up a bill that rotated which board this was under. You could set up a bill that was staffed by any of these boards. Arguably, they could all follow the same formula and be neutral. But you wouldn't be able to accomplish it. If this was a bill that has this under the Board of Nursing, I think you would have the physicians and other groups licensed under the Board of Medical Examiners raising the same objections about that bill. You're wandering into the same dangerous territory that you're trying to prevent. That's that observation. The second piece about this bill that is very nervous-making is the process itself will create a change in the frequency in which scopes will be expanded. It's the same way that MLAC reduces expansion of changes to workers' comp, or any process around an insurance mandate would reduce it. You now have two steps to go if you want to expand scope. I have to say, as the Oregon Nurses Association, we're on both ends of this conversation. We have situations where we're not comfortable with the changes to scope of practice of folks that currently work under the license of nurses. And frequently, particularly around nurse practitioner and clinical nurse specialist issues, we're trying to expand scope. So we get it at both directions. This is not an observation about, I've got nurses that could feel okay about this two-step process because it reduces the threats that they may feel from, I don't know, surgical technologists or mental health technologists or dialysis technologists. But on the whole, you need to recognize that if you have to go through two steps, it means there's two chances to say no and that most of these are expansions. So, for example, since I've been working here, the nurse practitioners have, and clinical nurse specialists have passed five bills to expand scope. Schedule 2, prescribing authority, dispensing authority. Senate Bill 880 had a whole number of things, a lot of which were specific fixes around things like being able to issue death certificates, be dispensing on college campuses. I could go through this long litany. The point is that if they had to come to some resolution with physicians before they came to this process, they would have not met that first standard. And even if you said, okay, rather than having to agree with physicians, we want you to try to bring us neutral information, it's interesting, these are groups that don't agree. There isn't such thing as neutral information in a lot of cases. In a lot of cases, the whole point is that they don't agree on what the access problems are. What will the consequences of an expansion be? It would have meant that for the last 10 years, as we try to bring those bills forward, the starting point would have been one that would have put our nurse practitioners at a disadvantage, and you probably would have had fewer of those expansions. So like I said, that may play to the advantage of some nursing issues and the disadvantage of others, but it definitely is going to dampen the expansion of scope. I think the last thing is that it's our belief that you could make the same case for the difficulty of any number of policy areas. Tax policy, insurance policy, energy policy, you name it. Being a legislator means having to try to tackle difficult questions. But when you move this back out to the professional association, one of the professional associations and licensing boards, one of the things you do in that process is you create a room of insiders who have turf battles, financial interests, an academic viewpoint. When you're moving out of that process is the kind of public input. Sometimes the right answer to do something is that people want to see their naturopath, or they want to see their nurse practitioner, or they want to see their acupuncturist, that there's a public demand or consumer demand in this process that brings you into this process, gives you a chance to evaluate it, and it's not incorporated into this bill. It's not where this bill is coming from. I think that there is disagreement among the public, just like there is among the providers, about the effectiveness of different treatments. And I'm not here to advocate for anybody else's turf, but one of the arguments you hear is that for some people, naturopathic medicine works better. Whether the science is there, whether you can have groups, you know, debate that behind the scenes or not, that's part of the analysis, is that there's a demand for it and there's people who want it. When they come forward to you as legislators, you hear that input. They're not coming forward in this process. So those are the lists of concerns. I'm not going to try to pretend that a lot of this isn't turf. I think a lot of it is. I think a lot of the way many of the organizations that aren't licensed on the Board of Medical Examiners will react to this bill is based on status and turf and who gets to be in charge. I think that's a good reason to not house it there. I think that's a good reason to house it someplace else, because I think that you raise the sentiment that this is not going to be an unbiased process.
All right, who wants to follow that animal up?
Suzanne
was
first.
Suzanne
was first.
I
don't have a question. I have a comment that Mr. Taylor very eloquently demonstrated the problems that arise from stating one's opinion about a bill before hearing the other side of the story.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're talking to you?
Well, I'm referring to myself.
Oh, all right. Representative Cota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this was not in BME, but some other lovely, more neutral entity, mm-hmm. would the nurses be supportive?
We were prepared to at least be neutral, and I was going to go back and see if we could be supportive if it was housed in the Office of Health Policy and Research.
Well, what about the Oregon Health Policy Commission rather than the office?
I think that there's a number of neutral bodies, including the dispute resolution.
To advise us on this kind of issue.
Another thing that we discussed in a work group is maybe having an interim commission or an interim task force. The reason that was rejected at that time was simply that you've got 19 different licensing boards and, frankly, more than that number of professional associations. And figuring out who was going to be on the task force in our group was more difficult than figuring out a neutral body to convene this. But, you know, that's a whole other piece of this. It's another route you could go.
Follow up?
Please. Mm-hmm.
And maybe the BME is not the right home. What I like about this bill is it's... The legislative body might not be the best place to be the first starting point for setting health policy, mm-hmm. and I think that's one of the things we struggle with. Sure, we could certainly have all the groups come to us, mm-hmm. especially if they can't seem to figure it out themselves. I mean, we act like, you know, court of last resort to some degree, but mm-hmm. if we're trying to fix a system and to look at access and a lot of different things, maybe there's a better way to do this, and maybe BME is not the right spot, but you raised good points.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair,
members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Try as we might, we did not get to a position of being able to support this legislation either. And let me first off by sharing that I understand your pain and frustration as a first session for me working on behalf of the naturopathic physicians. I've been stunned by the number of scope of practice issues that are brought to your attention, and I'm only monitoring them from the perspective of naturopathic physicians. You brought up some other optiologist type stuff that I don't even know where to begin with. So I hear where you're pain, but at the same time, give yourself some credit. The naturopathic laws here in Oregon are the best in the nation, and they are that way because of this legislative body. And while this process is exhausting and sometimes people don't get the results that they want, you know, the checks and balances seem to work reasonably well. That's how we got to the place that we are. And our concern is that the creation of this new process is going to grind it to a halt, and you'll end up with only the most modest of changes. I want to speak to the issue that Vice Chair Kotek just raised, which is there is a real feeling that there's a disconnect between profession to profession, and in many cases a lack of fundamental understanding of the philosophy, techniques, and practices and materials. And even a medical doctor who is supportive of naturopathic medicine doesn't necessarily understand the education and the skill level of a naturopathic physician. And that's in the best case scenario. At worst, they're just totally opposed because it's a competition, marketplace type thing. And let me close with this. This looks eerily familiar to the writing of ballot measure summaries. And you all know that I've been involved in quite a few ballot measure campaigns, and I think some of you have been involved in ballot measure campaigns. But you'll recall that in writing a ballot measure summary, two proponents are selected, two opponents are selected, and a fifth neutral party is picked amongst the four. Well, you know what ends up happening. The two sides can never agree, so you end up with somebody who is selected by the Secretary of State, and they're generally totally indifferent to the issues. They end up coming in, moderating to the very center, and not necessarily getting the best ballot measure statement or summary of the ballot measure, but they just basically kind of move this thing to the center, and you don't get the most accurate statement possible. I'm concerned that that this process is going to do that. You know, I went up and opposed this in the Senate, and it didn't feel good. I come before you today humble, and your earlier comments. At the same time, you know, maybe we'll be back in 2012, and I can tell you I told you so. With that, I'd close. Thank you.
Yes.
My name is, in case you've forgotten from yesterday, my name is Wayne Schumacher, the Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. Good afternoon. I'm here also to oppose 717 in its current form. The process in the Senate, I guess from lack of a better term, I think was quite disjointed and very quickly tried to band-aid together to jam this out. I don't think, first of all, everyone who had some comment wasn't brought to the table, and so consequently you have a bill here that I'm thankful that there were some folks that showed up that actually opposed this bill. It wasn't all sweets and candies, as might have been pointed out by Senator Moses Anderson. There are some serious, serious concerns, as has been eloquated this afternoon. And I echo Representative Bonamici's comments. Everybody that has a senator or a representative position probably thinks this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. The fact is, though, is that we created this many, many, many years ago, and the fact that, you know, medicine, MDs, are an as-taught profession. And as I started to say yesterday on another bill, technically a family practitioner could do brain surgery. There's nothing to prevent them from doing that. They're self-regulated, essentially, and attain those things by certifications. The rest of us aren't. We're legislated. And because of that, you all get the job. And I would echo, you all have done a great job, including your predecessors over the course of years, because I've been back here for 15 years, 18 years now, and I can tell you that whether we won or lost as optometry, the decision was a good decision. Either way, it's going to be back in your lap, and I would propose, as has been proposed, that this be worked on during the interim. We're certainly willing to do that because we think the idea has merit, but you have to, and you have asked yourselves, why haven't other states done this? And the reason is because it's just not this simple. I won't wax on about some of the other reasons because they've already been eloquated, but I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, this is less of a question than a comment. I am unwowed, to put it mildly. There are clearly value-laden questions here when we make scope of practice decisions at the legislature, but there's nothing about this bill that keeps the legislature from being the final arbiter on these decisions. And the value of this, it seems to me, is that it will provide information. It sort of advances the starting point. And the two sides may not agree. I think that the chair is right in his, you know, possible prognosis that many times they're not going to provide a consensus document to us, but they will provide information that aligns to the requirements of this bill. And so I think that it's been sort of mischaracterized in the sense that it's a done deal by this committee, by the committee that this bill sets up. I mean, to the extent that we have to make a value-laden decision as a legislator, and that requires some real wrestling with ourselves and our own values and the values of our constituents, I don't want that to go away. What I do want to go away is the wrangling about, you know, the medical value of whether of an optometrist or ophthalmologist, or questions that really don't seem appropriately within the purview of the legislature in the first instance. And I don't mean to be argumentative, and I didn't have a question, but I didn't want to get that.
I think the issue, and it's an issue I have, isn't whether we ought to have a process similar to this. The issue is the venue of the process.
And that's fine.
Exactly.
I think it's a serious issue. But, I mean, it is interesting. We set up the Oregon Health Policy Commission to advise the legislature on exactly these kinds of issues. And I mean, the Office of Health Policy and Research is an arm of DAS, but the Health Policy Commission should have been the one that should ask. And the other hand is, we don't have to ask them. I mean, we've set them up to
give something to do.
To do our job, to advise us on these kind of issues, and there isn't any reason why we couldn't assign them this task. Well, I think we need to talk about it. I think we need a real amendment.
Is it appropriate to comment?
Definitely appropriate.
Sure. To, again, for the record, Martin Taylor, Oregon Nurses Association, to Representative Candace's point, I think that the hard thing to convey outside of, you know, the experience you have as legislators is how these interactions between these associations take place, you know, sometimes when you're not in the room, when they are having conversations like this in the interim. And we work hard to try to solve our problems outside the legislative process, but it is an environment where there are partisans. And in this process is a little bit like saying that a majority party can select two Democrats and two Republicans, and they can get together and select two neutral folks and be staffed by Sandy, who's hired by the Democrats, and come up with a neutral report. Sorry, not hired by, I apologize, Sandy's
nonpartisan, and I was
nonpartisan.
Neutral
in the old era, in the previous, in the pre-commission reforms, which I should know all about since I didn't close to it. Stop digging, Phil says. The point is that it creates an environment where
you're going for three.
You already feel like you're behind the eight ball, even if that isn't the case. But when they select the folks on both teams, and you feel like there's going to be a bias in that selection process and how it's staffed, whether that's a fair perception or not, that's the perception you have when it's in the BME. So if you want to house it someplace else, you create a lot of opportunity for people to find a way to love a bill that right now they don't.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, again, Phil Donovan on behalf of OANP, you know, the challenge with the bill was twofold. Because, like I said, I could make a very good case, and it's based on your reactions, for why this is a good piece of legislation, and I tried to do so with the membership, but really it came down to two things. One was the BME, just the reaction was not positive to that, even though it's, you know, there have been attempts to make the language
more appropriate, but there were other ideas that were put on the table that were more readily embraced than the BME. And I've already spoken to that. But the second thing is legislation asks you to reach an endorsement or rejection and get to a consensus, and that's a lot to ask when you're setting up a program that's got two opponents and two proponents.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I missed obviously some of this conversation. If you don't reach consensus, you just say, well, these are the issues that resulted in a failure to reach consensus. So you don't have to reach consensus. I mean, that's how the bill reads.
Well, except Senator Miles Anderson said if they didn't reach consensus, the status quo would hold.
Well,
that was her view of that.
Mr. Chair, but I would suggest that the body would still receive a report, and they could still advocate for their position, and it's still an issue of doing their homework. Of if there's research that says nurse practitioners are equal to physicians in a scope of practice, then the research should be presented. And unfortunately, I mean, we don't have time in this process. And sometimes we don't have the expertise to fully vet the issues. If we found a better home, that I don't think anybody's going to disagree with the home. They have to have the administrative support and some robustness to support the process. And when the people, Cooper and whoever, Oprah, when they say, no way, that kind of shoots the theory to pieces. And, you know, the BME said, we'll do it.
Let's get the proponents up.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Claudia Back, Kathleen Haley, and John McCulley.
John, you were first in the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John McCulley, representing Oregon Psychiatric Association. I guess we're the poster child for whatever. And we are here on behalf of the Oregon Psychiatric Association to support Senate Bill 717. I think it's important to point out that, you know, to me, this provides a more thoughtful approach to the scope of practice issues that you wrestled with. And you know, ours in particular, I think it's difficult in the process of the legislature when you're facing the deadlines that you're facing to adequately evaluate the issues that come before you. This, to me, puts in place a process to allow that to happen. It allows more than a work group that meets a couple times and tries to hammer out a deal. It allows things that don't normally happen by themselves. I mean, the psychologist did not come to our association and say, hey, we've got this great bill, we want to introduce this session, why don't we get together and work on it? Those things just don't happen. This forces that to happen, and we think to your benefit that you will be presented with information that probably would not otherwise be available to you. And who knows, maybe a consensus will come out of it. And to answer the specific question, I don't know if this process would have resulted in an agreement on the psychologist prescribing bill. I really don't know that because there are people entrenched on both sides. But even in this process, this session, there were more discussions about possibilities than ever existed before. But in the heat of the legislative battle, those possibilities can't become reality. It can't become a consensus. Removing it, taking a step back, and allowing the parties to fully discuss the issue, to develop some trust between themselves, I think can make a big difference in this process. May not work. You will obviously be faced with these same issues in spite of this process being in place. But the fact that you have a sunset on it, I think it provides a great opportunity to have the legislature take a better approach to the scope of practice issues.
John, if we move this over to the Board of Psychological Examiners, will you still continue to support it the same?
Yes, we will, Mr. Chair. I think the point is to have someone who has the capability of convening the group do it. And this was a part of the work group that we had that discussed Senate Bill 717. The Board of Medical Examiners didn't stand up and say, hey, give it to us, give it to us.
Sure they did.
Yeah. There were efforts to, and Senator Mona Sanderson, to her credit, tried to find other locations of a convener. And you notice in the amendments, the language was specifically taken out that the Board of Medical Examiners would make a recommendation. The idea was to come up with as much neutrality in the process as possible, and yet still have somebody, as Representative Maurer said, with robustness to get the process moving. I think it's important to point out, too, as I was listening to the previous testimony, the Board of Medical Examiners does not appoint the entire committee. If you look on the bill, page one, lines starting at line 13, the proponents of the change actually select their members to serve on this committee. So I think that it's got a lot of possibilities.
Ms. Black?
Hi. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm here representing the Oregon Medical Association. We were also part of the work group that was mentioned before, and I will echo many of Senator Mona Sanderson's comments. We feel that the Board of Medical Examiners is an appropriate convening body. We are comfortable with the amendments that were adopted on the Senate side. We think that these issues come up, as you've heard and as you're aware of, time and time again, and we've heard frustration from legislators saying that there isn't enough time in the process to thoroughly vet the issues, and having them vetted during the interim with professionals in the community. You have your proponents, as Mr. McCauley stated, that are appointed by the board of the proponents, as well as the organization that supports them. And then the other two, the opponents by the Board of Medical Examiners, and then the two of them choose the neutral parties. We think this makes sense. This is a system that's very similar to MLAC that reviews workers' compensation issues. It's been an effective network for vetting bills prior to session. And we believe that the introduction of evidence-based information into the process will be beneficial. Also, the fact that was brought up as well is that the BME forwards information to the legislature, so there's still that process in place. Our understanding is that this is voluntary. People don't have to participate if they choose not to. And the fact that the law sunsets in 4 years, we also think is a good opportunity to really see how effective this is, if this is an agreeable process and effective. So we support the bill as written.
And if we move it over to the nursing board, you'll still support it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I knew you were going to ask that. And
or the physical therapy board?
A neutral party, we'd have to.
Are they neutral?
Pardon me?
Is the Board of Nursing Examiners neutral?
The reason that we thought, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the reason we thought the Board of Medical Examiners was maybe the appropriate body, and we did discuss other possibilities, was that they're responsible for the Medical Practices Act for the entire state. I still didn't answer your question.
No. Would you consider the Board of Nursing Examiners neutral? The Board of Nursing, whatever it's called.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I assume they would be neutral in this process, but we would prefer to see them with the Board of Medical Examiners or another organization that...
The Naturopathic Board?
Mr. Chair,
we would
prefer to see the bill pass.
We prefer to see it with your board, is what you're saying, right?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
I understand that perfectly. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Haley. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Examiners. Just a couple of comments. You're correct. We did not seek this role. And we do see it as a facilitative role and not an input role. The board does on a regular basis review scope of practice issues. For example, physician assistants have to have their entire scope reviewed by the board. Emergency medical technicians and paramedics also have their scope reviewed by the board. In recent times, the board looked at the issue of CRNAs and anesthesiologists. We had an anesthesiologist on the board, and the board decided the issue in favor of the CRNAs. So we do have some history of experience with convening these kinds of bodies. We worked on whether or not podiatrists should be able to operate on the ankle or not. I won't tell you how many years that took. So I think your timelines in this will be interesting to meet, you know, convening the group, getting everybody on board, and getting a report back. However, we are willing to do the Yo Woman's work and try to make it happen for you. Thank you.
Yes. A comment again. I think that the BME has an opportunity with this bill to show its impartiality, because I know that the Board of Nursing, if they thought that the BME was not impartial, that in fact, and they had some, clearly, you know, wasn't just a he said, she said kind of thing, but that you know, it's about your credibility and about your ability to be impartial in this process. And so I think whoever takes this on really takes on a risk, somewhat of a risk, that they can take a step back from who they are and be professional and be impartial. And so, in fact, I would applaud the BME for stepping up, knowing that theoretically this could be a political minefield if they chose to enter those or enter that field. So I would hope that the BME would be impartial. And
Tracy, you want to comment? You want to join us? I'm going to give her a chair.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Retton, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association, and I would say maybe a potential candidate for a poster child. Hopefully not in the future, but we as an association have not taken an official position, so I wasn't going to actually testify on the bill today, but I will let you know kind of where the Oregon Physical Therapy Association is at on the bill. When we first heard about the bill, we had also heard the rumors that this was the national effort of the AMA to sort of review the scopes of practice of all these professions. After talking with Senator Mona Sanderson about this, kind of asking her a little bit more about what led her to this bill, it became clear to us that that was not what her intent was, which did offer us some comfort. We, too, were hoping to have the oversight be by another more neutral party. And, you know, it was our understanding that they really did make attempts to find somebody else to take this, and nobody else wanted it. With that, you know, it might not be the, you know, our ideal bill. It might not be the ideal format for this, but we actually, I think, would like to see something along these lines happen to kind of force some discussions to happen prior to session. We've got some issues that weren't resolved this session.
And you wouldn't have a problem this being in the chiropractic board?
Oh, here we go with that question. Chair Greenlee.
I mean,
yeah,
it's a critical question.
I understand. I would have hesitations with that. You know, obviously, at least it's for the Board of Medical Examiners, which has no oversight over our board or their board. It's somewhat, you know, that's a tricky, you know, it's a tricky question. We want this to be as fair.
That's a good question. So here's why it's a straightforward question. We talk about ideological differences, but we're not talking about ideological differences. We're talking about significant economic and professional differences that relate to how each of these professions performs their job. And I mean, there is a serious question about who's neutral. That's the...
I would agree.
You wouldn't like it in the Board of Chiropractic.
I think that they would definitely have some concerns with that. I know that when the bill was amended, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I recall correctly, in the initial bill, there was more involvement in creating that report. And it appeared that they actually really did play a role in sort of writing that report and kind of looking at what those conversations were and reporting back on that. And that's been changed in the Ingress version. And that was something else that made us feel more comfortable, which is maybe there won't be agreement on the issues. They'll be reported out. And, you know, rather than having it come forward, and quite frankly, you know, it can be ugly, which I'm sure you're all aware of, and I'm not sure that it always looks great on either profession. And to have some of the issues not have to occur in front of this committee, if it can be avoided, I think would be beneficial.
Questions? Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can I close this group session?
Before you do that, Mr. Chair.
Ma'am?
I'd be curious to check in with Senator Monis Anderson about who they talked with, but, you know, maybe this is one of the things we don't ask, we just...
No,
the Health Policy Commission.
I very much like to check in with them.
You know, I don't know. Just, it's an interesting path to go down, I think. Versus Uber, I think the Policy Commission would be a better
choice. Well, yeah, Uber staffs them, but, I mean, asking...
Because there are legislators
the
on the Health
the
Policy
place.
Commission, so you have people who could,
right.
A, learn about the issue, even tangentially, so there would be some understanding before the session started.
And they have sub-processes that deal with issues very similar to this.
I agree that in the 2005 session, we had the advanced practice nurses coming, asking for prescribing privileges, the psychologists, the podiatrists were interested in some expansion. And it really drove me crazy. I mean, I was just opposed to all of them because what I was looking for was some universal way that you could deal with the question, should this is particularly with the prescribing privileges thing, how do you decide when it makes sense for A or B to expand the scope of practice to include this one? It wasn't included before. And I haven't been able to find out any general theory that would allow this to happen. So it seems to me it comes down to individual cases and the individual circumstances. Rather than saying, we'll set up these criteria and we'll go and we'll check this, and if you check 3 out of 4, you're in. If you don't check 3 out of 4, you're not in. I mean, that would be the ideal. It would be wonderful to do something like that. You look like you're...
I was going to say, you know, an example here where that may not, the check the box thing may not help is in Oregon is very progressive in its scope of nursing or its nursing practices. And it's not necessarily progressive in the medical community implementing the laws that are on the books, but the statutes are very permissive for nurses, nurse practitioners. Well, that's a whole other discussion, but the point is that because Oregon is out in front, there is no check the box system that you can go, well, this is how it worked in another state. Or are you saying check the box?
I'm saying here you have a profession that doesn't have prescribing privileges. Now, they want to have independent prescribing privileges. So here's a set of criteria you look at. If they meet 3 out of 4 of these criteria, then they should have prescribing privileges. If they don't meet 3 out of 4, then they don't.
But if there's no historical data from anyplace else, then you're kind of treading new water. And Oregon has done that.
It isn't only treading new water. I came to the conclusion that it was very hard to find this general set of principles that would... So that I came to the conclusion that it's one case at a time and you deal with the one case, which is what we were agonizing over, and we didn't like that. I mean, that was hard for us to do. Okay. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 717. I will, and Sandy will help me. I'll check in with the Health Policy Commission. I'll check in with Senator Monis Anderson and see whether that's acceptable option if the Health Policy Commission is interested in doing it. If not, we'll come back and talk about it here again.
Mr. Chair, before you close out the hearing, could I move to suspend the rules and allow Representative Bonamici to vote on Senate Bill 153?
I've already closed your hearing, which is what we need to do. Now, if you'd move to suspend the rules, that would be...
I meant close the meeting.
Yes.
I would move to suspend the rules so that Representative Bonamici can vote on Senate Bill 153.
Is there any objection? We ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules. Hearing none. Oh, and Representative Bauer as well.
Yeah. And I would amend my motion to include Representative Maurer to be able to vote on Senate Bill 153.
Great. Representative Bonamici?
I vote aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Okay. You have that recorded? I adjourn.